Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird, as always.
Here I am.
There he is.
I've been practicing all week for today's podcast. It's about sin, so I needed to get my game on. I'm trying to sin as much as possible this week, so I'd be ready to talk about it when we did the podcast.
I've read things that say that's pretty much that just another week for you.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Yeah,
there may be elements of truth to that as well.
Yeah. Well, I know we've said a number of times when we're talking about different people in the Bible where we try to put ourselves in the place of a sinner and just try to figure out what they're thinking. And so I'm sure it's always difficult.
Yeah, it is hard. I don't know if I've ever told you, I think I was 17 or 18 years old, and I met this guy on a Saturday night at a convenience store in the small town where I grew up. He was probably in his 40s, something like that, and he was like a street evangelist, and he told me, I'll never forget this, he told me that it had been 25 years since he had sinned.
Really?
25 years, yeah. And to this day, I still regret not hauling back and just punching him in the nose to see if he'd strike me back so that I could say, oh, I guess your streak is over. But I didn't. I was too kind, and I didn't have enough forethought to do that. But I've always wondered, you know, if he's still got that streak going, you know. Maybe it's 50 years now of no sin.
That's incredible. So, yeah, yeah. That dude is the dude that John Wesley was talking about, I guess. It is possible.
Evidently there is at least one person on this earth who's gone that long without sinning. Very impressive. Yeah. I don't know how he does it.
I was actually talking about this with somebody, and hopefully all this ties into the podcast if we're talking about sin. But
we're just kind of warming up. We're getting people ready.
Yeah, just the other day I was in the car with a guy. I was driving through Texas, your country. He said, are there people that believe that you can reach a point where you just don't sin anymore? I was like, yeah, that's a doctrine. Mm-hmm. And he goes, is that heresy? And I was like, well, I guess it's not technically heresy. It's not like condemned in a, you know, at any church council or in some creed or something, but it's definitely ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's so ridiculous. It can't even qualify as heresy. I mean, heresy has to at least sound as if it might be reasonable. No reasonable person believes that.
No
self delusional people maybe.
Yeah, no self. No person with like any degree of self awareness believes that's a thing. But
yeah.
And he goes, well, do they say that you do stop sinning? I'm like, well, I think it's more like it is possible to reach that point.
Yeah.
And so
theoretically.
Theoretically, you could get there. I haven't met that guy yet. Apparently, you have.
Either. No.
Well, apparently you have, though, Chad. Apparently, you have met that guy.
Yeah, that's true. The one guy. Yeah. Mr. Sinless, wherever you are. If you're listening, then hello from 25 years ago.
By the way, like the sure sign that you're dealing with an actual antinomian is a guy who told you he hasn't sinned in X amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's an antinomian for sure.
That would be a psychopathic antinomian. Yeah,
that's how it works. The real antinomian isn't the person that's like, oh, I just sin and sin and sin and sin. It's the guy who's like, that just refuses to let God's law have any place or play any role in the Christian life whatsoever.
Yeah, that would be the guy.
It's the guy that hears the law and says, crushed it. It's Rich Young Ruler stuff. All this I have done for the last 25 years.
Kept all those commandments.
What do I lack?
Give me more. I mean, I need a challenge here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those people, here's a segue for you. Those people would have no use for Leviticus chapter 4 whatsoever. Because as I told you, we were kind of warming up to this, and it really was. Because Leviticus 4 is about, of all the offerings, it's called the sin offering. So if you don't have any sin, you don't have to worry about a sin offering. I guess you're good to go. But for the rest of us, then there is a sin offering. And as we will see shortly, you got all kinds of offerings that are under the heading of the sin offering, depending on who you are and what you've done. So we talked about a few other offerings up to this point, the burnt offering and the meal offering and the peace offering. So this is number four, Leviticus 4, and the fourth kind of offering. And this one is, this one actually covers more than chapter 4. And this is one of those, we've seen these before, one of these cases where the people that divided the Bible into chapters and verses did not necessarily do that fantastic of a job. Because when you get to the end of chapter 4, of course, you assume, hey, we're done with the sin offering. Well, actually, you're not. Chapter 5 is going to continue that. So we'll see how far we get. We might dip our toes into chapter 5 as well. But let me kind of give you a bird's eye view, no pun intended, a bird's eye view here of what we got coming up in chapter 4. So basically, you have the sin offering divided into four different people or groups of people. We've seen this a few other places, and we're going to see it again. But one of the unique aspects of worship in the Old Testament is that depending on who you are, depending on your responsibility, your leadership position, that determines what kind of offering you are to bring. Or at least it gives you the possibility of bringing different kinds of offering. We've already seen, for instance, that you can bring a bull and some offerings, or if you don't want to, you can bring a goat or a sheep, or if you don't have enough money, you can bring a simple turtle dove, or even just a pinch of flour. So we've seen that already. We're going to see kind of a replica of that here. So the four different groups that are talked about in chapter 4 are, first of all, the anointed priest. Now, the anointed priest would be the high priest. So verse 3 starts out, if the anointed priest sins so as to bring guilt on his people, then here's what he's supposed to do. And then we skip down to verse 13, and that's the next section. It says, now, if the whole congregation of Israel commits a sin, well, then here's what they are to do. We skip down to verse 22, and we have the third person, and this is a leader. So if a leader sins, here's what he's supposed to do. And then we finally skip down to verse 27, and we have our fourth group. And this is basically, you know, Joe Blow on the street. If anyone of the common people sins, then here's what they are supposed to do. Now, these four groups of people, the high priest, the whole congregation, the leaders of the people, and then just your individual Israelites, this sacrifice, which is called the sin offering, is really for a relatively small number of transgressions. And all of these are what are called unintentional sins. So here's how the chapter starts out. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done and commits any of them, then here's what's supposed to be done. So these are, and the funny thing is we're not actually told, we're not given any examples of what an unintentional sin would be, but given the context and what we know from a few other Old Testament stories, this would probably be the kinds of sins which would be considered a desecration of the holy things of God. So, for instance, if you don't realize that if you've touched a corpse, that you're not supposed to come into the tabernacle and offer a peace offering until you've gone through a ritual cleansing. If you don't know that, or if you forget about it, then you and you do it. You know, say you've just helped your neighbor with their dead relative, or you've buried one of your relatives, and you touch the corpse, and by touching the corpse in the funeral preparations, you contacted uncleanness. Well, before you come into God's presence and offer a sacrifice, you're supposed to go through this ritual cleansing. Well, if you forget that, or if you don't know about it, then in doing that, in going into the tabernacle in an unclean way, you have sinned. It doesn't matter if you didn't know about it. It doesn't matter if you forgot about it. It's still a transgression of the law of God.
But by the way, most of my sins fall into this category.
Do they? Yours too? Yeah. I didn't realize that somebody else was like that.
Completely
too.
Oblivious, unaware, yeah. Unintentional transgression.
And that's kind of the way that the old Adam likes to treat sin, right? I mean,
I had no idea.
Yeah, I didn't know that was wrong. Yeah. Well, either that or it tries to just, you know, come up with extenuating circumstances, which more or less make it unintentional and inadvertent. I mean, I didn't mean to hurt you when I lied to you.
Yeah, I had a virtuous goal in mind.
Yeah, I had good intentions. I thought, you know, in the end, it would be the end would justify the means.
Yeah, that's obviously a joke. I don't think most of my sins fall in this category. This is part of the problem with if you study the Bible. The only downside is you know what all the sins are.
It's
a little tougher to plead to ignorance.
The more you study the scriptures, the less of a break you get, because you're much more aware of what's right and what's wrong. So these sin offerings are going to be for inadvertent transgressions, for unintentional acts that are committed by a priest or by a leader or by the whole congregation or by individual Israelites, whereby they break the law of God, bring guilt upon themselves, and are in need of cleansing. And I think this is actually pretty significant, because you will hear people maybe not outright argue, but implicitly argue that if you don't know that something is wrong, then how can you be held accountable for it? Well, in Leviticus chapter 4, we have it very explicitly stated that there are such things as unintentional sins. And God doesn't just kind of wink at those. He actually provides a means of atonement. So it doesn't really matter if a person is sinning outrightly with, you know, willfully, or if they're sinning unintentionally. All sins need atonement, and God provides that atonement for all sins. Now, this gets the actual ritual itself is very interesting. It's packed with all sorts of pretty heavy theological weight, and this heavy theological weight is going to draw us into the New Testament, because we're going to look at a few New Testament passages which are dependent upon Leviticus 4, and which actually really don't make a lot of sense unless you know the background of Leviticus chapter 4. So we'll be kind of jumping back and forth. So let me first of all describe what happens with each of these sin offerings. Now, we have four different groups, as I mentioned earlier, and it kind of depends on which group you're in as to what happens with the ritual sin offering. So the first two groups are very similar, and the second two groups are very similar. So I'll kind of deal with it that way. So if you are an anointed priest, so if you're the high priest, or if you are the whole congregation of Israel, then here's what's going to happen. You've sinned accidentally or unintentionally, inadvertently. So what you're going to do is you're going to bring a bull. This is like the bull is the highest offering, the biggest offering that can be offered, not just actually literally the biggest, but it's the most important. It's the most, it was worth the most in ancient Israel. I mean, if you offered your bull, this was a huge, huge deal. I mean, ranchers still today, I was raised in among farmers and ranchers, and bulls are still very significant. Cows, not so much. All you need is one bull for a herd of cows. So the bull, and the bull is going to determine what kind of calves the cows have, what kind of offspring they're going to have, what kind of quality they have. So you want to have a good bull, because the bull is the one who's going to produce the offspring, which produces money in your pocket. So just as it is now, so it was back then. Bulls are worth a lot of money. They're significant. So if it's the highest person in Israel, or if it's the whole congregation of Israel, They're not going to offer a turtle dove, and they're not going to offer even a goat or a lamb. It's got to be a bull. The bull is brought to the tabernacle, and just like we've seen in other sacrifices, the priest, or if it's the whole congregation, then the elders of the congregation, as representatives of the people, lay their hands on the head of the bull in the presence of the Lord. We've talked about that before, about this laying on of hands, this identification of the worshiper with the animal, and this idea of transference that goes on when there's a laying on of hands. So the bull is sacrificed, and then the priest takes some of the blood of the bull. Now, if I'm not mistaken, this is the only time this happens. He takes it not just to the altar outside, but he takes some of the blood into the holy place. Not the Holy of Holies, but the holy place. And he stands in front of the veil separating the Holy of Holies from the holy place. And with his finger, he sprinkles that bull's blood seven times toward the veil that hangs between the holy place and the most holy place. And then he takes some of the blood and he puts it on the horns of the altar of incense that sits directly in front of the veil separating these two rooms. Now, I want to come back to that in a second. Let me kind of finish the ritual. So after he's done that with the blood, after he sprinkled it toward the veil seven times and put it on the horns of the altar of incense, then he goes back outside. He pours the rest of the blood down at the base of the altar of burnt offering, which is outside. That's the main altar for offerings. Then he takes most of the fat of the bull and he puts that on the altar, and that's burned up. It's a fragrant offering to the Lord. And then he takes the bull's hide and all of its meat and its head, its legs, its guts, everything else, and that's taken outside the camp. Remember that phrase also for later. Taken outside the camp where they usually pour out the ashes, and it's all burned there. So none of the flesh of the bull is burned on the altar burnt offering. Its blood is poured out there, its fat is put there, but its hide and its head and its legs and its entrails and everything else is taken outside the camp, and it's disposed of there. That's what happens if the high priest sins unintentionally, or if the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally. Now, before we move on, let's go back and talk about a couple of things here. Now, you probably heard what happens on the Day of Atonement, on Yom Kippur every day. That's every year. That's when the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies with blood, and he sprinkles it toward the mercy seat, where you have the cherubim, in this throne room of God. Now, what is happening in the sin offering is sort of, it's almost like a miniature Day of Atonement, because the blood, the bull's blood that is sprinkled on the veil between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, and the blood that's placed in the horns of the altar of incense, it's almost like that blood is directed toward the Holy of Holies. It's like it's sprinkled in that direction. It's not taken in to the Holy of Holies like happens on the Day of Atonement, but it's sprinkled in that direction because that is where God himself is present. That's where God has enthroned himself. So this is kind of like, it doesn't go all the way like on the Day of Atonement, but this is like a miniature Yom Kippur, a miniature Day of Atonement, because the blood is taken into the presence of God. The blood is sprinkled toward the mercy seat, but it's blocked by the veil. And instead of going on the mercy seat itself, it's put on the horns of the altar of incense. So you have in this sacrifice kind of an ongoing preparation for and a foretaste of the Day of Atonement. Every time you have a sin offering for the high priest or for the whole congregation of Israel, you are celebrating the Day of Atonement in advance. This is a way in which you receive now, on the day it's offered, the forgiveness of sins, which is also going to be given full and complete on the Day of Atonement. that's the first thing that's very different about the sin offering, and very theologically significant, because it has so much to do with the Day of Atonement, which is a foreshadowing of Christ's atonement on the cross, on the altar of the cross. Now, talking about Christ's atonement on the altar of the cross, we have this very interesting phrase that occurs right at the end of this first section. Verses 11 and 12 says, the hide of the bull and its flesh, its head, its legs, everything that's left over, all of that is taken outside the camp to a clean place where the ashes are poured out, and there it's burned on wood with fire. Now, this phrase, outside the camp, does that ring a bell?
Where Christ was crucified?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm looking here in Hebrews 13.
Outside the city?
Yeah, outside the city. So this is the last chapter of Hebrews. Let me start here at verse 10. This is really quite an amazing section of Hebrews because of its Old Testament background. Here's what he says. I'm in Hebrews 13, verses 10 and following. He says, we have an altar. So he's talking to Christians. He says, we have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. So he's saying, yeah, okay, the Israelites, they who have not believed in Jesus as the Messiah, well, they have an altar, and they eat from their altar. They offer their sacrifices there, and they receive back some of that sacrifice, and they eat it. So their food comes from that altar. But he says to the Christians, he says, but we have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. So we have a different kind of altar. We have an altar, but it's a different kind of altar. And we eat from this altar. Then he goes on, verse 11. He says, because the bodies of those animals, he's talking about the Old Testament, the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the holy place by the high priest as a sin offering, and what we're just talking about here, Leviticus chapter 4, those bodies are burned outside the camp. So verse 11 in Hebrews 13, he's talking about Leviticus chapter 4, talking about animals, their blood's brought into the holy place. We discovered that. Their bodies are then burned outside the camp as a sin offering, okay? But then, listen to this, verse 12. He says, therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people, that he might make the people holy through his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Hence, let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For here, we do not have a lasting city, but we are seeking the city which is to come. This is some amazing stuff. So right away, what we see him doing is that he's saying, okay, the Old Testament Israelites, they had an altar. They ate from that altar. We have an altar, and we eat from that. We eat from our altar. That's Lord's Supper language there. But then he goes on to draw an immediate direct parallel between the sin offering in the Old Testament and what happens to Christ in his crucifixion. He says, in the Old Testament sin offering, the blood was brought into the holy place, and then the bodies of those animals were burned outside the camp. That's why Jesus also, he says, that he might sanctify the people through his own blood suffered outside the gate. So if you've ever wondered why Christ was crucified where he was, well, there's your answer. His crucifixion was the ultimate sin offering. Jesus was completing Leviticus chapter 4 on Good Friday. He was brought outside the camp. He was brought outside the city or outside the gate. And his site of crucifixion was the place where the body of the sin offering to end all sin offerings was burned up, if you will. In this place of crucifixion, you find the fulfillment of that place of ashes in the Old Testament, because here Christ suffers not only for for unintentional sins, but for all sins. For all sins, whether they are committed in ignorance or knowledge, everything is taken care of and atoned for in his sacrifice outside the gate. And so he says to us, hence, therefore, let us go to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach, because we don't have a lasting city, but we're seeking the city which is to come. So it's this idea of, so wherever Jesus is, that's where we go. He suffers outside Jerusalem, so the Christians leave Jerusalem. They bear his reproach, just like he bore their sin.
Yeah, when you talk about Hebrews, you got to remember that the author of Hebrews is writing to Jewish Christians who are having a hard time with the fact that Christ has not returned, and they're starting to wonder if they should hedge their bets a little. Maybe they should go back and do a little more of that sacrificial system. Maybe just in case.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Cover all bases.
Yeah, and what Hebrews is really about is that you can't do that. That you can't. You can't return to the city. And that the place where all your trust is for the forgiveness of your sins is outside the city, and you have to remain outside the city. And so he's not just talking to you or me or some Greek people. He's talking to Jewish people who absolutely know what he's talking about, because mm-hmm. not only did they grow up in it, they're, in some cases they are, and in other cases they're thinking about going back to it because of what they see as the delay of Christ. It's shocking, but we're not the first generation that thought surely Jesus was coming back in our lifetime.
Yeah, that's a great point. If you read through the whole Leviticus, time and time again, he makes the point that what God did in the Old Testament was good, but it was incomplete. It was waiting for its completion. And so in the sacrifice of Christ, in his priesthood, in him being the temple, in him being all of this that the Old Testament foreshadowed, he fulfills it. And so it's no longer adequate. It's no longer needed. It's no longer something which God wants us to do. So what he says to the Hebrews is, don't go back. Don't go back to the temple. Don't go back to the sacrifice. Don't go back to that Old Testament priesthood, because Christ has brought it all to fulfillment.
Yeah, I met a guy once he asked me about celebrating the Passover, you know, as a Christian, and observing certain Old Testament you know, days and this kind of thing, which in the sacrificial system, you know, it falls into that as well. And he says, you know, don't you think it'd be good to And they celebrated all this stuff. And he said, don't you think it'd be good to, you know, observe the Passover every year and stuff? And I was like, yeah, I think that would be about as good as planning a wedding forever but never actually getting married. Like, I mean, since I've gotten married, I don't go back and plan the wedding again.
Mm-hmm.
It's over, man.
Yeah. Yeah,
I can go back and look at the wedding plan. Like, yeah, that happened. That was a thing, but I don't go and do that again. The wedding has happened, and so no, I don't go. I know a lot about the Passover, but no, I don't celebrate the Passover every year. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and you can't just simply pick and choose what you want to celebrate, right? If you want to celebrate the Passover, then you need to celebrate also the Old Testament way of doing Pentecost and the Old Testament way of doing booths. You needed a Day of Atonement. And while you're doing all this, you better rebuild the temple with the altar and the priesthood and everything else, because Passover is not somehow like divorced from all of that. It's part of the whole Old Testament sacrificial liturgy. So you can't just simply say, we're going to do this, but not do everything else.
Yeah. I mean, as you read through Leviticus, one of the things that you need to understand is this is not easy. I mean, they've got people with full-time jobs doing this stuff. And I mean, the sacrificial system is not an easy thing to participate in. I mean, all these festival days, all of this stuff that is all pointing you to Christ. And like, one of the things that is great about the new covenant is the simplicity of it, where one man says, I've fulfilled all of that, and now all you need is me. So no, I don't want to go do all that stuff. All that stuff has been done for me so that I don't have to, so I can rest.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's a lot of work, man.
It is a lot of work.
I don't want to kill a bull. I don't want to do that. I don't want to have to do that.
We have it easy.
Yeah, sounds.
I don't know why we'd want to go back.
No, you don't want to go. And that's the whole argument of Hebrews. You don't want to go back. And not to mention that there is nothing to go back to.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the most important part. There is nothing to go back to. And even if someone tried, even if in Jerusalem today, I know there's some fringe groups that want to rebuild the temple and start the whole sacrificial system again. Well, if they want to do that, then I guess they can. But it's more than simply meaningless. It's actually an affront to God.
Well, in Hebrews, he argues that to do so is to re-crucify Christ.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anybody who imagines that by some sacrifice they make, it doesn't matter if some sacrifice that they make with their own life or some sacrifice they make with the life of an animal, anyone who imagines that some sacrifice that they make is somehow going to help out with their salvation is basically saying the work of Christ is insufficient.
Right. Right.
And so it's this idea of re-crucifying or trampling underfoot the blood that he shed for us.
Yeah, and the language that he used to talk about that is not simply like, well, it's re-crucifying Christ, which is not something you should do. It's a lot stronger than that. It's you cannot have Christ and the sacrificial system. That it's an impossibility. You can't have a little bit of trust over here and a little bit of trust over there. You can't. There is no hedging the bets. It's either Christ is sufficient for your sin and your righteousness 100%, or he's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You need the whole Jesus. You can't be dependent on him for 75% of your atonement, and it's easy to understand why. And the author makes this point, like. The blood of bulls is, I mean, to put any trust there is an affront to the blood of God. And then that makes sense. Like, what are you talking about? Like, I came and died. Like, all of this is just pointing to me. And the other reason why, like, you don't want to rebuild the temple and institute God's not there, man. Like, just if you rebuild the temple, other thing I assure you is God is not showing up. He's not gonna retake his place in the Holy of Holies. I could walk straight up into that thing and nothing would happen. I mean, someone might kill me, but God's not going to kill me.
Yeah. As I've said before, modern day Israel, Jerusalem has no more theological significance anymore than Berlin, Germany, or London, England,
right,
or San Francisco, California has. All these places are just another place now. The theological significance of the real estate of Israel has ceased with the new covenant. Sure, it's still significant in that all these divine activities took place there millennia ago, but Israel is no longer the chosen promised land of God. Wherever Christ is present with his gifts, that's the Holy Land.
Yeah, amen. So, amen. Yeah, man.
Let's plow on to cover the rest of this section. So the latter half of Leviticus chapter 4 deals with the sacrifices that either a leader offers or a common Israelite offers. And in these cases, it can be either a goat or a male goat if it's a leader, or a goat or a lamb if it's a common person. Now, what's different about these sacrifices, a little bit different anyway, is that, okay, the blood of the bull is taken into the holy place and sprinkled toward the veil and put on the altar of incense. But if you're just an everyday person, an everyday Israelite, or if you are a leader, then your sacrifice, whether it's a goat or a sheep, it's still sacrificed, but its blood doesn't go into the holy place. It only goes as far as the altar goes. And part of the animal is given to the priest as his paycheck It's not taken outside the camp and burned up like the bull, like happens with the bull. So there's some differences here depending on whether you are an average Israelite or a leader, or whether it's the whole congregation, or whether it's the high priest. There is a scale on these sacrifices, and the higher up you are, the more is required. Now, this actually fits in very well with the atonement offering, the sin offering that Christ himself is, because he goes all the way. He doesn't, his blood isn't just brought into the holy place. It's actually brought into the Holy of Holies. So if you're a high priest or the whole congregation sins, the blood of the bull is brought into the holy place. But since Christ is dying for all humanity, since he becomes the world's sin, then his blood goes all the way. It goes behind the veil into the Holy of Holies. It's placed on the mercy seat of the Father. And then he is taken outside the camp, and he dies there as a sin offering for all humanity. So everything that happens in Leviticus 4 is taken all that much further when it comes to the sacrifice of Christ, because it's the fulfillment of all of it. So Paul is alluding to this when to Christ as a sin offering, when, if I can find the passage here, when in Romans chapter 8, he says this. He says, what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did. God sent his own son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and as an offering for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh. Now, this is one of those passages that I mentioned early on where if you don't know the Old Testament background, the full meaning doesn't sink in. But in Romans chapter 8, verse 3, Paul is using the exact same language for sin offering that is used in the Greek translation of Leviticus chapter 4. The words are completely parallel here. So what Paul is saying in Romans chapter 8 is that, okay, the law could not save you. The law was weak because of our flesh. And so what the law couldn't do, God did. The law could only go so far, could only help you so much. It needed something else. And that something else was actually someone else. It was the one that God sent, the one who comes in the likeness of our sinful flesh. So he looks like us. He bears our flesh and blood. He's like us in all things except without sin. And he not only comes in our likeness, but he actually becomes the offering for sin. And in becoming that offering for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh in order that the requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us. So what the law couldn't do, the gospel does. What the law couldn't do, Christ does by becoming the ultimate and final sin offering, so that he might condemn sin in the flesh and fulfill the requirement of the law for us. So it's one more way that in this case, Paul, just like we saw in Roman, just like we saw in Hebrews, is taking Leviticus 4 and running with it all the way to the cross, so that you see that everything that was sketched out in these Old Testament sacrifices was then brought to its full color picture on Good Friday, where Christ becomes the sin offering, where he suffers outside the camp, and then he calls us out to him outside the gate, outside the camp.
Chad, it's almost like you're saying Leviticus is ultimately about the cross of Christ.
Almost, yeah. I think I might actually go so far as to say that. When you're reading Leviticus, get a cross and put it on the page of the Bible where you're reading it, and that gives you all the answers that you need, because everything is pointing there. It's all brought to fulfillment on Good Friday. I mean, Leviticus basically is one long preamble to Good Friday.
Amen. And Good Friday is coming up and not too long. So you know what? There's some stuff to think about for you guys if you belong to a church that does that sort of thing. And that is it, Chad. We've got to go. But hey, guys, May 19th, if you want to come hang out with me and Chad in North Dakota, we both think that you should probably do it, especially if you live around there. We know that there's not a lot of things going on in North Dakota. This is one of them. So you should probably come hang out with me and Chad. We're going to talk about the Psalms. We're going to hang out. We're going to eat some food. Chad, it's never not a good time, is it?
It is always, always a good time. Yeah, I mean, if you're anywhere within 1,000 miles, you need to be there.
I like that. 1,000 miles, you need to be there. You can go over to ChristWholeFast.org and go to the events page, and you can get all the information about it. All right, Chad, we will see you next week.
All right, man. We'll see you then. Thanks.